America.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
Wiggins America.
The only thing I'm going to need from you guys right now is a cup of coffee.
Wiggins.
Today's global economy waits for no man.
America.
Today's global business climate is like,
whatever, dude.
Hey! Politics is a dirty game. I'm not sure we want to play.
There are forces here at work that you couldn't possibly understand. You have no idea how high up this goes.
Welcome to Wiggins America.
We were talking to Bryce Hill this week on the Annie Fry Show about a new proposal from Governor J.B. Pritzker, who happens to be a Democrat. I don't know if you're aware of that. To tax unrealized gains. Now, if you're not familiar with the idea of taxing unrealized gains, I won't get too far into the specifics of how this works, but just realize that the words themselves give you really everything you need to know. This is a tax on money that you have not made yet. This is a tax on investments that you've made that haven't actually paid. Now, if you hear a tax on unrealized gains, which is the way they put it, and you go, yeah, that sounds like a pretty good idea, I just don't think we have a lot in common. That is such a unpatriotic, un-American idea that I'm not even sure really it's been done anywhere else. It's so radical and so far left and so communist to tax people on money they have not made that I think we've jumped the shark. Hey, this is Wiggins America, and welcome to it. Hope you are having a great weekend so far. Hope you have a lot of weekend left, no matter what time it is for you right now, based on your work schedule. But I bring that up because there's a shift happening in America. And so this tax on unrealized gains and ideas like it. So I'm not just harping on that one bad idea. But there are a lot of ideas like this, and that idea actually started, or at least gained popularity, under the Biden administration. So they were talking about doing this at the federal level. There's a lot of questions as to whether taxing unrealized gains is even possible. And also, by the way, if you hear that and you go, yeah, that's a really good idea, I already said, we don't have a lot in common. But here's the way they do it, because most people hear that, even if you're on the left, you go, man, taxing unrealized gains. Do you mean you would tax money that I haven't made yet? Just could I have it in savings? You know, I don't actually have that money, or my 401k and things like that. I don't really like that idea, no matter which side of the aisle you're on. Well, the way they do it is, and the way the Biden administration was going to do it, was to say, well, it won't apply to you unless you make a certain amount of money. And so then you hear that and you go, oh, well, at least it won't affect me. And then you quit fighting for it. And that's a terrible, terrible way to go about anything policy related, is to say, well, it's a bad idea, but it won't affect me. Like, if it's a bad idea, then it's a bad idea. And that's how they get it in. And of course, it'll start at, well, you got to make $100 million or more. And then it'll drop, or inflation goes up. And at some point in your life, you actually meet that threshold, possibly, where they either drop it far enough where it actually does affect you, or you keep making more and more and more without actually gaining any sort of class because of it, because of inflation, and you are in that tax bracket now. Kind of they meet in the middle there. And so, no, it may not affect you right now. It may not affect you for the rest of your life, and so you don't care about it, but it will affect you eventually, because then the idea has been implemented. This is the way they did casinos. So they came into St. Louis, for instance, and they said, hey, how about if we just have gambling on boats, and the boats have to make river tours? And the city said, sure, that's fine. We can just do that, because that limits a lot of people. There's very few boats that could do that, so it won't be rampant. And then they got in the door, and they say, you know what, though? It's costing us a lot to have to constantly make these river tours. How about if it's just boats that just sit there on the side of the shore? And they said, yeah, we understand that. It's costing you a lot of money. It's not really adding anything to the experience. If people want to go gamble, they don't need to necessarily go on a float trip. All right, we'll let you just be in the water. And then they go, you know what? It's costing us a lot to even just be a boat. How about if we have to have our building, but it's surrounded by water? And they go, oh, okay, it's all right. Yeah, you're making a lot of money and you're bringing us a lot of money, tax money. So we'll just allow you to have water around you. And they go, how about this instead? Instead of having water around us, we just have to be somewhere within, you know, 500 yards of water. You know, there has to be a lake or a river nearby. And they go, okay, yeah, well, we've gotten this far. We'll just change it to that. So, and it just keeps going like that to where now gambling is legal everywhere in the state of Illinois. I don't know if it is in Missouri. You'd have to tell me. I don't see it as much in Missouri. But I know in Illinois you can just stop at any gas station anywhere across the entire state. You can gamble all you want. It's all legal everywhere. Well, that's how it happens. It's slow. So they introduce something like unrealized gains. And you go, well, it doesn't affect me, but it will eventually. It'll just leak its way into everybody because the concept's already been legalized. Why do I bring this up? Well, because Illinois is talking about passing this. I don't know that it'll actually pass. And if it does, it'll be challenged in court like crazy because it is probably illegal to do that. But regardless, they're going to try. And it looks like they're kicking the idea around, at least in Illinois. And I live in Illinois, so obviously it would affect me at some point down the road. It wouldn't affect me now because I don't probably make enough for the threshold, but I have to bring it up because it's a bad idea. And the more bad ideas are implemented by any state or any governor, the more people look to other states around and they go, well, which ones are not doing that? And the first people to leave are always the richest because they're the ones affected the most by these policies. They're going to affect the people that the Democrats want to soak the rich. And so the rich leave. And then they go, well, who's rich now? And so they lower that bar. And they go, well, let's affect these people then. Well, then those people leave. And it gets to the point where even your middle class starts to leave and your lower class is left then holding the bag on a lot of debt and a lot of bad policy and just an economic blight on the state. And we're getting there. This is all theoretical for a long time, but we're actually seeing this really play out in real time in America right now. Where, you know, we've talked about this part of this a lot, where if you are a state that has good economic policy right now, whether you be a state that has recently enacted good policy or has always had it, people are moving there. People are moving away from the blue states and into red states. And that is because of things like unrealized gains and taxes and just bad stuff for business and bad stuff for people who do business. And that's going to continue. And here's the other thing. And here's the hopeful part of this. If America is 50 little laboratories of democracy, and we are watching this play out in real time, where people decide, I like this over here better than this over here. I've been under this. I don't really like the way this is headed. I'm going to move over here. It also has electoral consequences. And instead of me explaining that entirely, I pulled this clip from Harry Enten. Now, I don't think this is a brand new clip, but it's within the last year about migration patterns within the United States. And it's not just migration patterns. We talk about that all the time. People moving from blue states to red states is happening at a rapid pace. But it's those migration patterns and the political fallout from that movement within the United States that Harry Enten highlights here.
Take into account the population mid-2025. Look at this. The biggest population growth this decade, all five of the states that Donald John Trump won in 2024. Texas, Florida, North Carolina, Georgia, and of course the great state of Arizona where I spent my New Year's Eve. I love those folks out in Prescott, Arizona. These were the biggest gainers. The biggest gainers in terms of population compared to the 2020 census. Now, it's not just a red state boom. This is what we're looking at. We're looking at a red state boom here, but it is not just a red state boom. We're also looking at what I would dare call a blue state depression, because who are the people? Who and where are the people moving from into the red states? Well, they're blue states. Take a look here. The lowest domestic net migration this decade. All five of the states that were won by Kamala Harris in 2024. Look at this. California, Harris's home state. New York, where I'm coming from, coming from right now, of course, Illinois, New Jersey, and of course, the great Commonwealth of Massachusetts, which is a bastion of blue liberalism. These are the states that folks in the United States are moving away from and into the red states, which is propelling a red state boom. Now, this is interesting, right? But it could also have major political ramifications if it holds for 2030, the next census. Because take a look here. If, in fact, the 2025 population shifts hold for the 2030 census, look at this. Look at the House seat shifts by state. Remember, of course, we apportion the number of House seats depending on the population in each state. If, in fact, the 2025 population shifts hold for 2030, states that Kamala Harris won, they would lose. They would lose 7 seats in the United States House of Representatives. The states that Donald Trump won in 2024, they would gain 7 seats. Now, this isn't just about the House of Representatives, right? It's also about the Electoral College, because the number of electoral votes that each state gets is equal to the number of senators. Each state, of course, has 2, plus the number of House seats that they have. So what would this mean for the House of Representatives? Well, if you remember back in 2024, right, it was all about, we were talking about the blue wall. If Kamala Harris could win the baseline Democratic states and then add in the blue wall states of Michigan, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, she would get to 270 electoral votes. But if all of a sudden we, in fact, have applying the 2025 estimates, the population estimates, to the Electoral College, the blue states plus the blue wall of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin would no longer be enough. Under the current estimates, you get to exactly 270 electoral votes, the minimum needed to win the Electoral College. If, in fact, you apply the 2025 estimates, look at that. You would only get to 263 electoral votes if you were a Democrat, which would mean a Republican victory.
They call that voting with your feet. People leaving bad policy, moving toward good policy, and states that allow them to flourish. That's all people are looking for. They just don't want the heavy hand of government saying, mine, 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 mine. They want the government to stay out of their lives for the most part and say, you know, we're here to serve you. You are not here to serve us. And the states that have that in mind are growing the fastest. And you're going to see that play out more and more and more through all of this migration in the Electoral College and in the House of Representatives, especially at the federal level. This is Wiggins America. We have a lot for you in this show. Stick around. You know, someday this will not be the party of Donald Trump anymore. At some point, the man won't be alive anymore, so you'd have to think at that point. So I guess it depends on how you're referring to the party as being the party of Donald Trump. Is he in charge of it right now? Absolutely. Is he still flexing those muscles? Absolutely. And maybe, if things play out the way that I still believe that they will, involving election integrity and theft, and not just with elections, but with a lot of things. This man may go down in history as, you know, one of the greats. He may be a Mount Rushmore-style president. That's all to be determined. Right now, he does not deserve that. He is a difference maker. He is a generational president. But is he on Mount Rushmore? Not yet. He could be. Yeah, I know. You're going, wait a minute. Did he just say something clip-worthy? I think I did. If there's ever a reason to clip something that I said for audio, that's probably one of them. But anyway, it remains to be determined is my point. But at the moment, the party, as far as, you know, who's in vogue and who's not, the Republican Party, that's up to Donald Trump, because voters listen to that guy and they are going after the candidates that he goes after. And I mean by, you know, saying that they're not in favor with him, like Thomas Massey and all of the Indiana Republicans who voted to keep their maps from adding a Republican seat. Have no idea why. Get to that in a little bit. But if he endorses you, you got your meal ticket punched, at least in the primary. In the general, that remains to be seen. But here is Bill Hemmer of Fox News giving you the rundown on his success rate.
Races and Senate races. This is his scorecard, okay? He has endorsed 8 governors. Now, some of these races weren't real close, didn't have a lot of competition, but some of them did. I mean, we saw what happened in Louisiana, the primary with Bill Cassidy. We saw what happened a week ago tonight with Tom Massey in Kentucky. And now we're seeing it again tonight, okay, in Texas. Governor level, Trump endorsed 8. He won 8 times. U.S. House, 101 endorsed. He won, 101 endorsed in the House, and he won 101. Let me put on the pencil right here and show you this. U.S. Senate, Sean, he has endorsed 8 candidates. And prior to tonight, he had won 8 times. And now you can take the endorsement from 8 to 9 endorsed and from 8 to 9 winner. Ken Paxton was outspent 9-1. Got the endorsement from Trump, got the endorsement of Wesley Hunt, the congressman who got knocked out 2.5 months ago. And now we got the setup in Paxton and Tallarico. Many Republicans felt if John Cornyn could win tonight, that he could be an easy winner over Tallarico. We'll never know that now. And a lot of Republicans felt that they could save a lot of money, too, if Cornyn won. But that did not happen. Here's what will happen, Sean, in November. In Texas, probably the most expensive Senate race that we have seen ever.
And here is one of those most recent successes as of this week. That is Ken Paxton, who won his primary. He's very much a MAGA candidate in Texas running for Senate against James Tallarico, who is very, very far progressive left. Which is a weird choice in Texas, but you're going to have your hardline right in Ken Paxton and your really far progressive, even socially progressive left in James Tallarico running against each other in Texas. It's kind of a bizarre race. It'll be a national attention getter. And Paxton won that against Cornyn. And of course, that was, I don't want to say a shock, but Ken Paxton was not necessarily favored to win that race until Trump swept in at the last second and endorsed him. Here's Ken Paxton.
President Trump is the leader of our party, and his endorsement in this most is the most powerful force in politics. And I'm honored to have his support, and I look forward to working with him in the Senate to deliver for Texas.
I don't get the candidates right now who are not seeking endorsement from Donald Trump. And maybe some are and who aren't getting it, who really did want it. But some who are, you know, they're really kind of running from it in a way. Cornyn was not that guy. He wanted the endorsement without doing anything for it. But why would you go against Donald Trump? Now, if you're going to stand up against the leader of the party, then you are putting yourself in political peril. And that's okay if you're doing it for the right reasons. But what are your reasons? In the sense of John Cornyn of Texas, the guy had been a multi-term senator. What exactly was it about Trump and Trump policy specifically that he didn't like, that he wouldn't go along with to get the endorsement of Trump, which was available to him? The Save America Act to keep non-citizens from voting? You wouldn't push harder for that? Well, then you don't actually have principles. You're just part of the old guard and you don't like the new guy. The Indiana Republicans were the same way. They, some of them, and it wasn't all of them, stood up against Donald Trump. Well, this is, we don't have to change our state legislative map just because Donald Trump wants an extra seat to try to keep the Republicans in control of the U.S. House. We're going to stand on our principles. The problem is, what are your principles? What exactly were you standing against Trump on? This had already been, gerrymandering has been going on forever. And you're going to say, oh, well, we're not going to gerrymander? You already had gerrymandered. It's an 8-1 map. The state is an 8-1. So you've already did it. So you're not standing on principle by adding the 9th one. What is wrong with these people? And guess what? All of them lost their primaries. So it's not only politically stupid, you're also not actually standing for anything so that you can walk away with your head held high. I don't get some of these people. But anyway, conclusion is, after this week, Donald Trump still very much in charge of the Republican Party.
All battles are spiritual in nature. Wiggins America.
You know, you're known as a reality TV star. Do you think that that is, in your campaign for Los Angeles mayor to run the biggest city in California, is that a label that you embrace? Is that hurtful to your campaign, or does it help, you think?
I mean, the reality, pun intended, is that was from 20 years ago. And if we look at what Karen Bass was doing 20 years ago, she was in Cuba learning how to make bombs with the people that would then go bomb Capitol Hill. So if we're looking at backgrounds, I'm pretty proud of what I was doing at 20 on reality television, even though it was, you know, I may not have been the most likable character, it was still TV versus trying to destroy America and going to Cuba 20 times and praising Fidel Castro. So against my opponent, my background's pretty strong.
Why is Spencer Pratt surging in the LA mayoral race? Well, two reasons. He's fighting two things. One is worthlessness, and the other is corruption. Worthlessness because you have a lot of leaders, and this is across the country. And it's not specific to party, although it does tend to be more Democratic. And it tends to be more on the local level, too, especially with Democrats. Like governors, as probably about as high as they go. They never really make it to president, like Kamala Harris. But mayors, man, Democrat mayors, they're actually just in they don't really know what they're doing. They're so bad at running anything that they should never run anything. And in fact, some of them are career politicians because of that. They can't actually run anything. So they get in there attempting to do things, even far left things, and they can't do it because they don't know how. So it's ridiculous. But that's the first thing. The second thing is that he's fighting corruption. Now, some of them will get in there and do, you know, have big goals to get rid of homelessness or whatever and not be able to do it because they're worthless. Other ones will take cuts off of the top and they'll hire buddies and they'll get a lot of money flowing through these NGO systems that ultimately comes back to them on the back end, or it sets them up for after political life to be very wealthy because then they'll be a part of one of those NGOs. And that's all corruption. And that's a waste of taxpayer dollars. And Spencer Pratt is fighting all of that. And he does so in a very direct way. I will give him credit. It's not just that he's fighting those two things. He does so in a way that really cuts through message-wise, which is not an easy thing to do as a political candidate in general, let alone one running in Los Angeles for mayor. It's actually been pretty impressive. Here's the thing, too. J.D. Vance, you know, this whole administration, I don't get why people would say that these people are incompetent. Man, this whole administration is full of very competent people. Now, you may not like what they're doing, especially if you're on the left, but they're very competent and they move fast. Here's J.D. Vance talking about fighting fraud.
Let me just recap for the benefit of our friends of the media. In just 2 months, we exposed billions of dollars in benefits that have been stolen from the American people. We've referred over $22 billion in fraudulent small business loans back to the Treasury for collection. We've deferred more than $1.3 billion in fraudulent Medicaid reimbursements that were coming from various states, particularly California. We put a six-month hold on enrollments for new hospice and home health care providers because so many of the newer hospice providers were not actually providing hospice services, but were just focused on fraud. So we're going to cut that out for a little bit and try to get to a place where we can actually certify that the people providing hospice services are actually providing those very necessary and important services. We've recovered taxpayer funds from the $135 billion stolen after the floodgates were open in the immediate aftermath of COVID. We have found $6.3 billion in suspected fraudulent government contracts, which were mostly awarded during the last administration, and that has stopped. And finally, we've blocked $60 million in student aid fraud that should have gone to young people trying to get an education, but instead we're going to fraudsters. And I think the theme here of the anti-fraud task force up to this point has really been that we're protecting two classes of victims here. We're protecting the American taxpayers who shouldn't have their money stolen by fraudsters. And of course, we're protecting the people who need these services.
The heads of these organizations are actually making changes. It's just tough to turn these huge ships. It takes time. But I'm glad to see there's prosecutions happening with fraud. There were two Somali women who were charged with, it was something in the range of like $100 million or something of fraud that these two people had committed. And by the way, if you notice, nobody's coming back and going, hey, you shut down a legitimate daycare. That would be incompetent. But that's not what's happening. They're all fraudulent. They're not fighting back. They know that they're committing fraud. Stephen Miller is another one of those voices in the administration who's an effective communicator for sure. And he is talking here about fighting fraud in welfare and I think Medicare. Here, I'll play the clip.
Not abiding by our laws. And the amount that has been fleeced from us
is in the hundreds of billions of dollars. I believe, based on what I've seen and what I've heard, is that we could balance the federal budget if the only dollars that went out of the Treasury went to individuals who were properly, lawfully, correctly eligible to receive them. And that ultimately is going to be what we have to do as a country. In the meantime, because of the Vice President's leadership, you are seeing the most muscular, robust, aggressive, dedicated, determined, and speedy effort to shut down criminal fraud that has not only ever occurred in the history of this country, but in any developed nation. So thank you.
Now, what he says is hundreds of billions of dollars. Now, that could be 200s of billions of dollars, or that could be 900s of billions of dollars. That's a big difference. You're talking about one that's close to a trillion, one that's closer to 100 billion. Now, that's a big, big difference. So the fact that he's even talking about the possibility of, hey, what if we could balance the budget is great. Because all I want to know is, and I want to see action behind this, I want to know that they're still talking about possibly balancing the budget. Because that doesn't ever get talked about at all anymore. And it will, at some point, fall off an absolute cliff. And then we're going to go back to these kind of things, these comments, these podcasts, these radio shows that you've been listening to for years and years and years. And you go, oh, there it is. This is what we've been warned about. Except that it won't happen probably in any sort of cliff fashion. It'll happen like a slow roll down a fast hill. And so it'll be painful, but you won't be able to point, just like socialism happens slowly and then everybody's poorer. The people who are in socialism aren't able to point at it and go, oh, that's what's caused this. The overspending, the devaluation of the dollar, the constant programs that just keep going out and out and out and out that that don't benefit. That nobody points at that and goes, well, that's actually where it is right there, because it's not a cliff. It's something that happens slowly. And that's my concern here is that, yeah, we'll just never balance the budget because we don't ever have that boom pain. We had a little bit of it in 2021 and 22, and we kind of are still feeling the effects of that. So my hope is that we do have a generation now that looks at overspending and goes, oh, there are actual consequences from that because we spent so much during COVID that we are still feeling it. But I don't know. Do you think we'll ever get there? I hope so. I'm just glad to have leaders who are still making it a priority and talking about it. Now, I do want to see action, though. Thanks to everybody who prayed for me while I was in the hospital last week. If you didn't hear me on the Andy Frye Show, from last Tuesday, so not this week, not Memorial Day week, but last Tuesday through Friday, I was in the hospital and, just had a bad lung infection. You probably have heard me talk about it if you have any connection to the show at all, about having cystic fibrosis. Well, it plays out like this, where I will get some sort of mild cold at times, and most of the time I will barrel through it. Sometimes it takes a little longer to get over. But in this case, I got a mild cold in probably February, and I've just been working really hard, doing a lot of labor outside of the radio. And I don't know if maybe just push myself a little bit too hard, especially in the winter, but just wasn't able to really get over it throughout all of February and March. Went on an antibiotic, just a pill, in March through April. In March. And then it kind of was okay. Got me through it. But just kind of pushing through. And then it got worse again, and then went on another antibiotic at the beginning of May, and it just didn't kick it. It wouldn't kick this thing that I've had for way too long. And so finally decided, okay, I got to go into the hospital and get hooked up with a PICC line, which I still have in my arm right now, and do the IV antibiotics. Well, that's worked, and it always does. It kicks this thing right in the teeth, and then sets me back up for good baseline for however long, and hopefully that'll be a long time once I get this thing out on Tuesday. But anyway, that's what's gone on. That's why you didn't hear me last week on the Andy Frye Show. That's why people have been saying, you know, I've been on some prayer lists, and I really appreciate that because that means a lot. I will say this. Being in the hospital is pretty boring at times, but it's also, it's just like when I had babies, twins. I said, it's the most boring, overstimulating thing in the world, because nothing's really getting your mind, but you never stop doing stuff. That was the way it was with twins. Well, that's the way the hospital is a little bit too. Nothing's really enjoyable, but you're constantly seeing doctors and respiratory therapists and whatever's constantly. So you don't really even get to rest that much. I will say the one thing that I got done really well this time was that I've been writing this novel for just about a year, and my goal was to finish the first novel in a year. And I actually wrote a first draft, and then I wrote a whole first draft of a second novel that's the sequel, and I'm about halfway through the third one. And I stopped, and I had my editor, who is my wife, look at the first one, and she just ripped it apart. And so I've been rewriting that whole first novel for a bit of time. And man, going to the hospital, you have no distractions other than just those doctors. So I was able to get that thing nearly completed. And I'm pretty confident now that I'll be able to have that thing fully edited and ready for release sometime around maybe September or October of this year. Because you got to go through the process of getting cover art and all this different stuff done too. If you want to do it right anyway, it's a process. So it's not just getting the book done. It's about all the other stuff too. And I feel pretty good about that. And I'm actually very, very glad to be able to share that novel with you. I think it's going to be called The Swine Things, which is a weird title. It's kind of an adaptation of a very old, scary novel from the turn of the century, 1900. But it's a much more, fast-moving version of that. Because the old stuff, if you ever read really old novels, man, there's some cool stuff and there's some really good writing, but they are paced poorly. And so that's what I'm trying to fix to make what is going to be my first non-comedic novel ever or book ever, because the first two I've released, The Life of Human and The Grocery List, those two have a lot of humor in them. This one does not. It is just plain scary, or that's my intention anyway. We'll see once it comes out. But anyway, I say all that to say I have some time. And one of the things I do when I have time is research random stuff like this.
Wow, Wiggins America.
Here's what I discovered. Apparently, in 1981 and 2, the band Journey was at their peak. And they decided that they wanted to commemorate this moment in their band's journey, the journey of Journey, by becoming a video game. Which they did twice. The band Journey became a video game, or they had a video game modeled after their band two times. The first one was in 1982 for the Atari 2600. This was a really bad game. I watched a little bit of the game, and there is no real reason why you would think, oh, this is Journey. This is the band Journey. You played Pitfall at the time. It's the same look, the same style of characters where you're like, this doesn't look like the band Journey. It just looks like a little Pitfall guy with a couple of pixels. But you control all five band members at a time. You begin with, here's the overall goal of the game. You begin with $50,000, and you must dodge obstacles coming at you like roadies and band managers and stuff, but some of them are good and some of them are bad. So you want to avoid some of them that take your money, and you want to grab some of them like your band manager, who gives you a cash boost. It's basically just one of those back and forth games, like shooter games, where you're just trying to avoid stuff and grab other things. And for some reason, it's Journey. I don't know that the game is worth a lot, but it's just weird, and I found it interesting. But that one is not nearly as interesting as the 1983 Journey arcade game that was made, fashioned around the band. Now, this one actually does look like the band, because they used real digital photographs of the band members' faces, including Steve Perry, Neil Sean, Steve Smith, Jonathan Cain, and Ross Valerie. And so as you're playing each level, you're playing as one of the band members. But it looks so bizarre, because you know how South Park will sometimes grab a real person's face and throw it into the cartoon? Well, that's intended to look kind of stupid and bad. This game is even worse than that, because you're talking about 1983 technology, and they just slap these photographs of the Journey band members on a Pitfall looking guy. But the game itself is really weird. The the point of it is that you are Journey and you are traveling through space, and I guess some crazy planet are such big Journey fans, and they find out, oh my gosh, Journey's traveling in a spaceship by our planet. Let's kidnap them. But they don't quite kidnap the band. They just get all the band's stuff. So each level that you play as a different band member. For instance, when you're Steve Perry, you navigate through a swing set or a bunch of gates to try to find Steve Perry's microphone. And then you have to shoot and destroy the gates. And it's all in space. And then Neil Sean, you have to navigate a cavern using a jetpack to reach Neil Sean's guitar. And each level is different like that. And they play MIDI versions of the band songs. So Neil Sean, you get Chain Reaction. When you're Steve Perry, you hear Don't Stop Believin'. And then at the very end, once you've gathered all the band's instruments and materials, then you get to play one last kind of boss level of the whole band together playing a concert for this planet as Journey. And your only point at the end of that is to ward off crazy alien fans. So you just control the roadie in front of the stage and you're just blocking fans from getting to the band. So do you find that interesting? Because when I went into a rabbit hole, I could not stop reading about these crazy things that you don't even know exist. And here's the last thing I'll say before the end of the show. So apparently that arcade game was not meant to have Journey as the focal point of the game. It was meant to have you as the focal point, but they couldn't do just you because the technology at the time had a camera on the arcade machine that would take your picture and put your face into the game. But on test runs of the game, people were just flashing it with their junk, and then their junk was the face of the band or the whatever it was. And they realized, oh no, we can't do it this way. Let's try to make this whole game in retrofit it to be a Journey game instead and use Journey songs. And Journey was down for it. Isn't that bizarre? Those are the kind of things that you research when you're in the hospital by yourself. All right, this is Wiggins America, and now you're smarter. We'll see you next week.
America. This is America.